Thanks, John. It's great to be here in Scotland. When I was in Uganda, I had to speak slowly because no one could understand my accent. And I thought, well, that would be okay. And then I thought, actually, maybe not, because I'm from down south. So I hope that you can follow me. When I get excited, I speak too quickly. So if you can't understand what I'm saying and it descends into an unintelligible babble, then please wave and tell me that. And I genuinely tell me that, because there's no point in you humouring me while babbling along to myself if you can't follow anything I'm saying. It's also lovely to see some old friends. I've just seen Agnes, who I think I last saw in about 2003, about 20 years ago, and I didn't know she was here, so it's fantastic to see her. Amy I know well, maybe some other people as well. Andy at the back. So thank you for the invitation. It's lovely to be here with you. And we've got quite an undertaking. We're going to try and do the whole of 1 and 2 Kings in one day. And obviously that is impossible, and so we won't cover everything. And so we're just going to cover some things. And I kind of don't mind how many. So if we don't finish the handout, I'm not going to feel sort of super repentant about that. There's probably more here than we can cover. We'll cover some of it. I hope we'll get an overview at least of the main sections of the book, a bit of a grip on it, and some bits of it we'll look at in a bit more detail. I always say that the best way to understand a book of the Bible more than you do at the moment is to read it more times than you have. And it sounds obvious, but it really is true. So simply by reading a passage again and again and again, you find you understand it better than you did when you read it the first time. And the reason 1 and 2 Kings seems mysterious to many Christians is mainly just because we don't read it very much, and it's just unfamiliar. So just by reading it more times, you will understand it better. When I was at Bible College some years ago, we had a course on the book of Revelation. And it was an unusual course because the exam wasn't on, do you know such and such a theory about the millennium or whatever. That the exam was simply, do you know what is written in the book of Revelation? So there were questions like, what was the second horseman of the apocalypse? Or describe two things that happen after the third seal is opened. Or, you know, it's that kind of question. And you weren't allowed a Bible, you just had to know it. And the only way you could revise for the exam, therefore, was to read the book of Revelation once a week for the whole semester. But it was actually a brilliant course because it turns out that the byproduct of reading the book of Revelation once a week for a term is that you started to understand the book of Revelation much better, actually, than if you'd been reading all these crazy theories about the millennium. I think that's true of every book of the Bible. It's true of 1 and 2 Kings. And one of the things we do in our church is to approach books of the Bible a bit like you should approach pork belly. And let me explain. Apologies to vegans here, but let me explain this analogy, which is dear to my heart. Apparently, my sister's a chef, and she tells me that with pork loin, you can just flash fry it for a few minutes. You don't want to cook it too much, and that's great. But with pork belly, you have to cook it for hours, and then it tastes amazing. The best way to understand the Bible is to approach it like pork belly. So spend a long time slow roasting it. Don't try and do it in a hurry. Don't think, I'm preaching 1 Kings this Sunday, help. That's going to be very stressful, and it will be quite tough and chewy. But if you can find a way of roasting it slowly. And we kind of build this in our church in the way that we do small groups. And I'm just going to, this is a little aside, but I commend this to you. So we have, and I inherited this from St. Helen's Bishopsgate, where I was on the team with Amy for some years. But we used to have leaders' Bible studies a fortnight before church Bible studies. And in the leaders' Bible study, you studied exactly the same passage that you would study with your groups. And we studied it. It wasn't just, here are the questions. It was, let's study it together so we really feed on it ourselves. And then we'll pass it on to what we've learnt personally. We'll pass on to the church in 2 weeks' time. But then, of course, you had to prepare for the leaders' study because you were expected to come with a really good knowledge of it yourself. So we had a, and then before we started the term, we did a kind of overview of the book we were studying on a leader's day. And then at the end of the term, we did a review of what we'd studied. And that meant that basically every passage of the Bible we studied at the leader's day, in the leader's, and then in your own preparation, then in the leader's study, then in the group study, and then in the review. So we basically studied every passage 5 times. And I found that those books of the Bible that I've studied like that, I know much better than any other book of the Bible. Normally you do one Bible study or one sermon and then you move on. But if you can find a way of revisiting something again and again, and let me tell you, 1 Kings, thank you very much for inviting me to speak on this, because this is an old friend for me, which I have been for about 5 years now, revisiting again and again and again. But I don't get bored of it, I'm enjoying it most now, because now it's sort of slow roasted and it's ready to eat. So I hope you'll enjoy it. Now, because of this conviction that familiarity is the best way to understand the Bible, one of the things we do at our leaders' training days is we start with a test, because the challenge is, don't look scared, but the challenge is try and read it as many times as you can before you come, and as a bit of fun, we'll give you a test to see just how well you know it. And I thought I'd do that for 1 Kings, but it's going to be no one's going to mark your exam, don't worry, but it's a sort of fun test. And all it is I'm going to tell you 8 characters from 1 Kings whose names begin with J, and you just have to give them a rating out of 10 for how good or evil they are. So let's make it an evil score. So 10 is the most evil, and 1 is really pretty good. Okay, so 5 would be neither good nor evil, somewhere in between. This isn't about your doctrine of total depravity, by the way. I know everyone is evil, but this is, you know, sort of how manifestly evil they are or how much they've been redeemed by the Lord. So here they are. Here are the 8 characters. Score out of 10. 10 is the most evil. 1 is the most good. And firstly, Josiah. Secondly, Jezebel. Thirdly, Jeroboam the First. Not that Jeroboam the Second is much different, actually, but... fourthly, Jehosheba. I'm putting some mean ones in that you may not have at your fingertips. Fifthly, Jehu. Sixthly, Joab. Seventhly, Jehoshaphat. And eighthly, Jehoiakim. And if some of them you know immediately and some of them you don't know immediately, that is in itself an incentive to read 1 Kings more times, because you will know if you read it. But I thought we'd mark it together, and we'll do it by cheers and boos, okay? So boo for evil, cheer for good. So Josiah.
Hey.
Yes. Jezebel.
Boo.
Okay, I thought we'd start with some easy ones. Not many girls' names called Jezebel. In fact, my sister... Yeah, he's not a Christian. She's not called Jezebel either. But she's just had a baby, and she said that, Andrew, I want a name beginning with J from the Old Testament, because her partner's Jewish. And so she said, well, we're thinking of Jericho, but I just wanted to check it doesn't have any bad associations. And I said, actually, the associations of Jericho are almost uniformly bad. How about Josiah? But in the end, she went for Judah, which is, you know, pretty good. But fortunately, not Jezebel. Jeroboam the First.
Boo.
Jeroboam the First, I think, is the king who's mentioned most often in the book of 1 Kings. So shame on you if you don't know. He's always described as Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. It wasn't just that he sinned, but he led everybody else to sin, because he made, you remember, the golden calf shrines in Dan and Bethel, and basically invented his own religion and led people astray. That's the heart of the issue of the king, actually. If the king is faithful, he can lead the people into faithfulness. But if the king is evil, he can lead the whole people into evil. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. Jehosheba. Yes, I thought that might be a hesitation. Jehosheba, hooray! Jehosheba is a godly sister who hides her baby brother from her evil grandmother, who's trying to kill him. And she brings him up with the help of Jehoiada the priest, secretly hidden in the temple. 2 Kings chapter 12. Jehu. Yeah, now that hesitation, it might be because you don't know him, or it might be because you know him really well, and you know it's quite an ambiguous question. So Jehu is the fastest driver in the Bible. He drives his chariot like a madman. He also kills a lot of people in 2 Kings. But he is an agent of God's judgment, and he's acting for Yahweh in bringing God's judgment on the house of Ahab. And God says about Jehu, you've done what was right in my eyes and according to all that was in my heart. So Jehu, for his assassinations, gets a thumbs up. Although he was also an idolater himself, and he gets the thumbs down. So he's a kind of mixed character. Joab? Yeah, boo. He changes sides to support Solomon's rival, Adonijah, and is killed for it. Jehoshaphat? Jehoshaphat, so he's a good king. He loves the Lord, king of Judah. He's also, I think, the most gullible man in the Bible, for reasons that I hope we'll get onto later today. He is extremely gullible, but his heart's in the right place, for the most part. Jehoiakim. Sorry, they're getting harder, aren't they? Jehoiakim is the king at the very, very end of 2 Kings, when everything looks most desperate, and yet through Jehoiakim is a glimmer of hope. So at least that tells me that there's lots to see, and there's some things you're not very familiar with. And please read it, because all of these characters have fantastic stories. But let's begin. We're going to zoom in very quickly in the book of 1 2 Kings. But I thought we'd start with the story of the whole Bible. And, I mean, obviously you know the story of the Bible, but I like to just keep repeating this for the sake of my church, just to keep it simple. And I'm afraid you've missed, just because of the way that Microsoft Word never prints the same on two different printers, you've got part of the diagram missing. But it should go like this. And that's a one. You've got the one missing, and then two, and then here's a cross, three. Here's the story of the Bible in three sentences. God made a fantastic world, number one. We messed it up, number two. But God will fix it through Jesus, number three. I mean, that is basically the shape of the story. God made a good world, we messed it up, but God will fix it through Jesus. That's the story of the whole of the Bible. It's also the story of Israel. And there's I've said that the story of Israel is like a Russian doll miniature of the main story, but hidden inside. Let me change the color. So if that's the story of the world, then this is the story of Israel. See, it's got the same shape to it. So let me explain. In the story of the whole world, it starts with Adam. In the story of Israel, it starts with Abraham. Adam lived in the Garden of Eden with a command from God, which he broke. Do not eat from the tree in the middle of the garden. If on the day you eat of it, you will surely die. He breaks the command, and so he's evicted from the Garden of Eden, and he waits for a savior who will be a second Adam. That's the story of the whole world. It's the same as the story of Israel, isn't it? The story of Israel. Israel lived in, well, eventually they lived in the land of milk and honey, or as I prefer to call it, the land of sticky toffee pudding, because if you get milk and honey and you boil them together, that's what you get, isn't it? Dairy plus sugar, sticky toffee. And they live in the land of sticky toffee pudding with God's law, which they break, and so they're exiled, and they're waiting for a savior who will be a second Israel. It's just the same story. In a place of paradise with God, evicted from that place because of sin, waiting for a savior to come. So that's the story of the Bible. That's the story of Israel. But then within the story of Israel, the eviction actually happens in sort of two stages. So it goes a bit like this. The kingdom gets divided, and then the northern tribes go off into exile first to Assyria. And then the southern kingdom takes a bit longer, but then eventually they're also exiled to Babylon. And then they're waiting for a savior, and they come back. So that's the story of Israel. It's kind of the same shape, but a little bit nuanced. And then just before their exile, we have these two themes, and I've drawn them as a crown and a house. There's a king and a temple. And 1 and 2 Kings is basically this bit of the story. So you get a land with a king in it, a great king actually, Solomon, and there's enormous blessing of living under the reign of King Solomon. And then there's a temple, an amazing temple, layered with gold everywhere, and you get the amazing privileges of God's presence and access to God in prayer. But then gradually everything starts to go wrong and it unravels, and the shape of the whole of the book of Kings really is one of decline. So it's gradually getting, from that point, it gets worse and worse and worse. And it ends with the northern kingdom of Israel going into exile in Assyria, the southern kingdom of Judah going to exile in Babylon, and we're waiting for some sort of hope of restoration. That's the book of 1 and 2 Kings. Now, what does it tell you about? Well, you could say it's a story of decline only. You know, here's a story of how everything goes wrong. That's your kind of glass half, half, which way around is the positive one? Half empty. Half full. I can't remember which one is positive. Anyway, this is the pessimist way of looking at it. It's just a story of decline. But at the beginning of 1 Kings, the good things it shows us about king and temple are actually a glimpse of the ultimate king and the ultimate temple. So at the same time it's telling you, look, things are going wrong, and it's telling you, look at this glimpse of things when they're put right. There are good things to see as well as depressing things to see. It's depressing how we've lost it, but it's tantalizing, the glimpse that we had of all that was good. Now, I've put here three routes from then to now. How do we get from the world of the Old Testament to the world of the Christian? Again, this is all kind of groundwork, and it may be very familiar to you, but three principles that I use and I teach in our church. The first one is that God's the same. God doesn't change. The easiest way to interpret the Bible rightly is just to ask the question, what do I learn here about God? Because what God was like in 1 and 2 Kings is still what God is like now. So in any chapter of the Bible, if I learn a truth about God's character or God's promises, they haven't changed. That's a very easy thing to get right. Secondly, the Christ comes later in the story, the salvation history, the Graham Goldsworthy Gospel and Kingdom, the Vaughan Roberts God's Big Picture, the kind of Bible overview that many of us do. That just says keep reading. If you keep reading, eventually this story gets to Jesus. And then the third one, Christ is prefigured in the story, typology. I think of the relationship between number two and number three a little bit like really old web pages. Now, again, if some of you are really young, you won't even remember this. But in the early days of web pages, they were mainly just pages of text with hyperlinks on them. Does anyone remember these days? And this is amazingly exciting because it was a text that you could read the whole thing, you know, like any page of a book. But if you clicked on a hyperlink, it would jump magically to another part in the document. And the hyperlinks were blue, and when you clicked them, they turned pink. I'm saying this just for the nostalgia of the people who do remember that. But I think that number two is a little bit like reading the whole story. So you have to just keep reading down the web page. And eventually you get to Jesus. He comes later, 700, 600 years later. But typology is a little bit like hitting a hyperlink where you jump immediately to Jesus. And there's lots of different places in the story that will be very Jesus-shaped or like a shadow of Jesus or make you think of Jesus, and you can get directly there. And we need a combination of the two. And in particular, I think the way it works is if you look at the big story, the salvation history story, the overall shape is the shape of the red arrow. It's a downward spiral. And you kind of say something like this, oh, we haven't got to Jesus yet. We're still not at Jesus yet. People are still in sin without Jesus here. And it's basically a story of how things get worse and worse and worse and worse and more and more and more desperate. And then finally Jesus comes. So salvation history gives you quite a gloomy view of 1 and 2 Kings. And of course, you know, that's right. And there's Bible overviews in the New Testament, like Stephen's one in Acts chapter 7, which is basically that shape. He says, you always reject God's prophets. And this is just typical of you. And he gives a Bible overview of decline and sin. But number three is a little bit like the orange dotted line. It's the thing that says, well, this kingdom of Solomon, it's a little bit like the kingdom of Jesus. Having a king who's really wise, like Solomon is, makes us think of how wise Jesus is. You know, it's a kind of more direct link. There was nobody like him, we're told, who's Solomon for wisdom. And yet we're told of Jesus, in him are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Or when we look at Solomon's temple and we realize this is the place of access to God in prayer, where heaven and earth come close. You think, that's a little bit like Jesus. Jesus is the place of access to God in prayer. He is the new temple. And so there are various points in the book, and we'll see the same with Elisha. He's got the same name as Jesus, or almost the same name. His name means God saves, just like Jesus means God saves. And he's a judge, he's a savior first. That's a bit like Jesus. Jesus is going to be the judge of the world, and yet before he comes to judge the world, he gives people the offer of salvation first. So there'll be lots of kind of hyperlinks that will take us to Jesus, glimpses of Jesus, but the overall story is going to be one of decline. And I think when I first studied the Old Testament, I only really used Numbers 1 and 2. I used God is the same, and I used the big story. And I think my Old Testament preaching was quite pessimistic. And 1 and 2 Kings is, you know, in some way, I mean, it doesn't end on a high. It's quite a depressing book at the end. But it is full of grace and full of glimpses of Jesus. And I'd invite you to look for those and take them as typology. The little box is another thing that didn't work. Sorry, that got cropped out. But what it should say is, aside, back to Corinth. If you're studying on Cornhill, you probably know this principle. And people call it back to Corinth because of when you read 1 Corinthians, you go back to Corinth. Obviously, it's not helped to go back to Corinth when you're reading 1 and 2 Kings. But that's the name of the principle. What was the original context into which this book of the Bible was written? So 1 Corinthians was written to people in Corinth. What was going on in Corinth? Why would Paul have written these things to Christians in Corinth? Because if I understand why they needed to hear it, then maybe I can understand why I need to hear it. It's a great principle. It's harder to do with the Old Testament than the New Testament. So in the New Testament, often the book of Acts will give you some clues or context in the other letters. You know who it's written to. In the Old Testament, it can be harder because sometimes we just don't know. It doesn't say, oh, well, it was written, you know, the book of Job. I mean, when was it written? Who was he? And we just don't know. It's there in the Bible, but that's about as much as you've got to go on. So it can be tricky, but sometimes we do know. So, for example, the book of Deuteronomy ends with the saying, and there hasn't arisen a prophet like Moses until this day. Well, that tells you that Deuteronomy was published sometime after Moses died, at the time when people were really looking forward to another Moses. So the whole book is shaped by, if only we could find another mediator like the one that we had. And that's really helpful. You know, you get a handle on it. Similarly, with 1 and 2 Kings, we can work out when it was written or when it was published, partly because of where it ends. So it ends with in exile with only a tiny bit of hope. So, you know, if they'd been back in the promised land, they'd surely be celebrating that in the book. But instead, it's a kind of, we're in a mess, how did we get here kind of book. So it can be helpful to think of the first reader sitting by the Kibar Canal with Ezekiel and his friends and Daniel and thinking, let's retrace the steps of what went wrong. Let's replay the car crash in slow motion and learn from it for next time. It's that sort of, that's how the first reader is going to read it. And when they read the happy bits of 1 and 2 Kings, they're going to read it with wistfulness. Oh yeah, they were great days, weren't there? Before we rejected our God. I look at the paradise that we lost. There's me that kind of sense to it. So it can be helpful to do that. But also, I want to caution against just always saying, but of course we know this goes wrong because they're in exile. That's true. And of course they know that. It's like when you watch the Titanic film, you know, you already know it's going to sink because that's just the famous thing about the Titanic. Like they already know they're going to be in exile. And yet, there's a sense in which, as a reader of a narrative, we get caught up into the narrative. So as well as the time that the first readers are actually living in, there's the time that we enter into as we join the story. So I think, you know, when you read the high days of Solomon, where everything is great, you could read it thinking, oh yeah, they're great now, but they're not going to be great. you know, like this Titanic is going to sink. Well, that's true. But also you're kind of enjoying the party on board the ship. And you're kind of experiencing what is joyful and wonderful about the days of Solomon. And again, as a Christian with the typology in mind, you're kind of glimpsing something about Jesus. And I'd encourage you to do both. I wouldn't collapse the whole thing into where it's going to end up, because the story is going to carry you on the highs and lows of the story. And it will actually have a greater force if we allow ourselves to be happy when the narrative is happy and then dashed when the narrative dashes. Okay, over the page. A brief history of the monarchy. This is the, we're going to be in 1 Kings very soon, but this is the essential background, I think, to understand the kings. And obviously we got kings before the book of 1 Kings. The first kings of the Bible come in, well, the first Israelite kings come in the book of Samuel. But even before we get to the books of Samuel, we learn about kings in the book of Deuteronomy. And I just want to read this to you because I think it is foundational for the book of 1 and 2 Kings. And I think the writer of 1 and 2 Kings expects us to know this. You know, the structure of the Old Testament is the law and then the prophets. And the, so you've got the law and then the prophets. And in the Jewish Bible, 1 and 2 Kings is one of the prophets and the former prophets. And you know, then later you get people like Isaiah and Ezekiel. But the law is, sorry, the prophets are built on the law. They expect you to know Genesis to Deuteronomy as the foundation. And we'll see that at various places. But in particular, they expect you to know what it says about kings. Verse 14 of chapter 17, Deuteronomy. When you come to the land that the Lord your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you may indeed set a king over you, whom the Lord your God will choose. Now, as an illustration of the fact that I do not know Deuteronomy well enough, I think I totally misread 1 Samuel 8 every time I did a Bible overview. So you know in 1 Samuel 8 they say, make us a king like all the nations, they say to Samuel. And we say, look, this is terrible that they should want a king like the nations have. This just shows that they're, you know, it's like in that game of, anyone played the computer game Civilization? I know it's really old now, but that was, that sort of my, you know, and you, in the book of, if you don't know, don't worry, but I used to play it with my dad when I was small. And in this computer game, you kind of advance through different stages of civilization. So you start as a despot, and then at some point you advance to a monarchy. And when the nations around you are doing it, if you don't do it, you get left behind. So we just say, look, this is terrible. They're just trying to conform to all the nations around them. But Deuteronomy tells me it isn't awful to want a king like all the nations. That's okay. God anticipates that. He permits that. There is something awful about it in 1 Samuel 8. We'll have to look more closely to see why. But the very fact of wanting a king like the nations doesn't seem to be bad, because Deuteronomy says, when you come and you possess it and say, I'll set over a king like all the nations, you may have one. But you've got to have a king whom the Lord your God will choose. One from among your brothers you shall set as king over you. You may not put a foreigner over you who is not your brother. Only he must not acquire many horses for himself, or cause the people to return to Egypt in order to acquire many horses, since the Lord has said to you, you shall never return that way again. He shall not acquire many wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he acquire for himself excessive silver and gold. Even as I say this, you're thinking of where the story of 1 and 2 Kings is going to go, right? With Solomon and really quite a lot of wives, 700. Really quite a lot of horses, really quite a lot of gold. You might say excessive gold. And God's already warned that right at the start, you can have a king, but make sure, here's the stipulations, not too many wives, not too much gold, not too many horses. Oh dear. So if that's how it goes wrong, how will it go right? Verse 18, when he sits on the throne of the kingdom, he shall write for himself in a book a copy of this law approved by the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him. And he shall read in it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by keeping all the words of this law and these statutes and doing them, that his heart may not be lifted up above his brothers, that he may not turn aside from the commandment either to the right hand or the left, that he may continue long in his kingdom, he and his children in Israel. So too much gold, multiple wives, multiple horses, that's the route to disaster. The route to faithfulness is to read God's words. And in fact, even to copy them out so that you learn them. And again, that already is going to tell us the key turning points of 1 and 2 Kings. Even before reading 1 and 2 Kings, the whole thing is here. So Solomon, very rich, very prosperous, loads of wives, bad. It's going to go wrong. It does go wrong. The kingdom gets torn in half. It's the beginning of the decline. And then the best high point in 2 Kings, King Josiah. What's so great about King Josiah? Well, someone finds a copy of the law and reads it out to him, and he takes it really to heart. And he repents and he tries to totally change the whole of the country to line up with God's words. Unfortunately, it's too late by then. But those are the contours of the story. And Deuteronomy, we're expected to know it. And then I'm going to go quickly through this, but this is just because my Bible overview of Kings was wrong. Maybe yours is wrong. Maybe yours is better than mine. But just the things I learned. I was always told in Judges, you're told that you need a king. So you know that refrain, in those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did as they saw fit. You know, we need a king, we need a king, we need a king. Well, that's true in Judges 17, 18, 19. But in Judges 8 and 9, wanting a king is a terrible thing. They tried to make Gideon into a king. And they shouldn't, because it was actually God that won the battle, not Gideon. And Gideon kind of goes, no, far be it from me to be the king. He acts all humble. And then he has a son and calls him Abimelech, which means daddy is the king. So it obviously goes to his head. I quite like the idea, though. I won't be the king, but let's call him daddy's the king. And then Abimelech is a horrific king. And you remember Jotham's fable about the thorn bush? All the trees have got together and they've made the thorn bush into the king. Not the olive tree, not the fig tree, but the thorn bush. And Jotham warns, fire will come out of that bush and devour the people. And there's a massacre. So it's an awful thing. To want a king like that is a disaster. And yet at the same time, we could kind of do with a king. And so we get this the same thing in 1 Samuel 8. They want a king in spite of God's word. In spite of God's warning. They don't like Samuel, they want someone else. It's bad. But in 2 Samuel, and this is the famous passage that you know, where God makes the promise to David that there will always be a king on his throne, that his dynasty will be an eternal dynasty. So the point is, the Bible overview of kingship is mixed. Kings are good, or kings are terrible. They can go either way. And I think the key to it is this, that the king that is a disaster, I'm going to do a two ways to live like diagram. So this is God. That's the two ways to live sin diagram, right? But this kind of king is a disaster because this kind of king is offering an alternative to God. A king who's doing their own thing, leading people their own way. That is a terrible king. But this kind of king is fantastic because he is mediating the rule of God to his people. And he's bringing God's rule to bear on the nation. So it all depends basically whether the king himself is aligned to God and as his king or not. Does he listen to God's words? Does he pray before the Lord? Is he himself aligned with the Lord? In which case he'll lead the whole people to the Lord. Or is he doing his own thing, in which case he leads the whole people to do their own thing? Psalm 23 is a brilliant summary of this, because David is a shepherd, like literally a shepherd. I mean, that's his job before he gets recruited. And shepherd becomes a metaphor for being a king. So he left shepherding his flock to be shepherd of God's people. And yet in Psalm 23, he says, "The Lord is my shepherd." And that is a great thing to say. If you just, I know it's a famous verse, but just think about it theologically. David is saying, "I'm shepherding the people and God is shepherding me." The Lord is the shepherd's shepherd, or the Lord is the king's king. Yeah, that's this. Everything's lined up. That's good. And we'll see that in 1 Kings. Then in Ezekiel, we again discover that there's terrible kings, terrible shepherds, and then God himself is going to come and be the true shepherd. So expect in the king to see either a glimpse of what we really need or a glimpse of what can turn us so badly wrong. Okay, that's a brief overview of the monarchy. And then finally, before, by way of introduction, a brief comment on the structure of the book. How do you divide up 1 and 2 Kings? And there's some, it's always good with Bible books to try to look for clues that the author himself has given us about how to break it up. I always think of Bible books like chocolate bars in this sense, because chocolate bar manufacturers decide for you how big a portion should be. And so, like, you know, Toblerone, quite a big mountain is one mouthful, apparently, which I like that. Whereas other ones, you know, they're, and Galaxy bars, they kind of do it so that the grooves aren't very deep and you can never break a Galaxy into the actual piece. You always get 1.5 pieces, which I think is meant to be a deliberate accident. Anyway, chocolate bar manufacturers, they decide where the portions are meant to be. And is 1 and 2 Kings more like a Toblerone or more like a Galaxy? You know, can you tell where the pieces break or not? And there's some things that are clear, other things that require a bit more nuance. So one way of doing it might be to look at the royal obituary. So the book of 1 and 2 Kings is divided into kings, kind of obviously, and you get the reigns of different kings, and they all sign off in a very similar way. So we're told at the end of almost every king's reign where to find out more. Now, the rest of the Acts of Jeroboam, they're written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Israel. By the way, that isn't the book of Chronicles. That's a book that we don't have anymore, which is a sort of book of history of kings. It can't be Chronicles because Kings is written before Chronicles. But this is that. If you want to read more, go and read that other book. How long they reigned for? The time that Jeroboam reigned was 22 years. Where they're buried? And he slept with his fathers. Who succeeded them? Nadab, his son, reigned in his place. Yeah, you get that kind of formula. Where to find out more, how long they reigned, where they're buried, who succeeded them, for more or less every king. You also get an evilness rating. He did good in the sight of the Lord. His heart was devoted to the Lord, as David his father had been. Or he did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He followed in the ways of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who... can you remember? Made Israel to sin. David is the benchmark for good kings. Do they love God as much as David did? And Jeroboam is the benchmark for bad kings. Are they idolaters like Jeroboam was? And actually, every king of Israel is in the line of Jeroboam. In every case, they followed the ways of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin. And in the case of Judah, yeah, it depends. Some love God, some don't. So that kind of works, and you know there's certainly paragraph breaks there, sometimes bigger breaks. But the trouble with breaking the book into just different kings is some kings get multiple chapters to themselves. You know, 11 chapters for Solomon, and one paragraph for another king, for Shalom or someone like that. So you know, if you're going to do that for your Bible studies, something's going to be quite long, and then you're going to have 5 Bible studies in a row with one paragraph long kings who are almost all the same. So it just doesn't really seem to be the literary way that the author's doing it. What he seems to do is slow down because he wants a big focus on Solomon, and then speed up because he wants to cover 8 kings all at once to show that they're all the same. So you don't want to do the 8 kings all at once section in 8 sermons. That would be one sermon, because it's meant to be an overview. Where Solomon is going to probably require more than one sermon. So we can't just do it by the royal obituary. What about the Israel story and the Judah story? So after Solomon, the kingdom divides in two. There's a civil war. And there's 10 tribes go north and into become Israel. 2 tribes go south and become Judah. So can we follow the Israel story and then the Judah story? Well, we kind of can. And there are sections of the book that are all in Israel or all in Judah. For example, we'll look later at the Omrid dynasty, Omri and his son Ahab, and his son Ahaziah, the particularly evil kings of Israel. We're in Israel for a whole long section, and then we cross the border, and that's quite significant when the camera angle moves to cover Judah. But sometimes the two storylines get mixed together. In fact, sometimes the two countries get mixed together because there's intermarriages between the two. And someone from Judah, who's meant to be a good king, lets his daughter marry somebody or lets his son marry somebody from Israel, where there's an evil king, and the whole thing gets messed up. So again, the author doesn't really keep them apart consistently. So there's a whole mixture of factors, basically, and this is my best attempt so far. So I've just put down section breaks and bigger sections as far as I've managed to work out. So Solomon gets a whole section to himself. He's about the first sort of third of the book, or the first quarter of the book. By the way, when I say the book, I mean the book of 1 and 2 Kings. It is one book. The only reason it's split into two is because parchment scrolls weren't long enough, and so you just needed to start a new one. But there is no break between 1 Kings and 2 Kings. In fact, you'll just notice it breaks in mid-chapter, really. And then the story of Ahaziah has already begun at the end of 1 Kings, carries on in 2 Kings. So ignore the division, maybe even cross out the title and just put an arrow. This continues to read. So in the book of Kings, 1 and 2 Kings, Solomon gets a big section. Then the divided kingdom, the kingdom torn apart. We get a few kings pretty quickly in that. And then we zoom into the family of Ahab, Omri, Ahab, Ahaziah. But here, it's actually not the king that's the most important character. It's the prophet who speaks to the king. And so we've got an Elijah section that spans more than one king, an Elisha section, more than one king. They are the two superheroes. I think Marvel is missing a trick by not doing the Elijah-Elisha franchise. But I'm a bit scared if they do, because Hollywood's got a really bad track record of doing Bible stories accurately. So have you seen, I remember a few years ago I did an evangelistic series on the Bible according to Hollywood. And each sermon was a different Hollywood film. And then I said, but this is what actually happened in the Bible, like contrary to the film. And so we did Exodus, Gods and Kings. People seen that? And Noah. I mean, Noah the eco-warrior, he misunderstands God's a weird dream that God gives him and thinks it's better to eliminate all of humanity so that the animals can enjoy the planet without us. I mean, no, that is not the story, right? The story of Noah is really good. We don't need to improve on it. I remember seeing Noah, and I was about to watch Exodus, Gods and Kings, and I talked to a friend who works in the film industry. I said, Francis, I saw Noah, it's awful. I'm about to watch Exodus, Gods and Kings. I'm hoping it's better. And he said, it's not. That was a good summary. It turned out, surprisingly, that Raiders of the Lost Ark was the most biblically accurate of all. So anyway, they should make the movies, but I'm nervous if they do. And then Elijah and Elisha, and then the last big section of the book, the downward spiral, which is where everything goes down the tube. I think those are pretty much the main 5 sections. You might be able to do better, but those are some principles. Then the Bible Toolkit is just an attempt I made to try and capture some of the principles in reading the Bible. And I'm just going to use this as a quick opportunity to do a cheeky plug for a website that John and I, maybe he's already told you about this, but that's the website, and we're trying to make some videos that aren't so much for Cornhill people, but you might enjoy them and they're quirky, but the idea is they're to try and introduce our churches or people who aren't used to serious Bible study to some of the kind of principles that we use at Cornhill. So it's a way of making it fun and hopefully accessible, And there's some videos there. I think there's three so far. One's coming out in a couple of weeks' time, and we're going to try to add to them. But if that's useful to you, it's all free, and just use the resource, have a look. But that's a new out thing. Okay, let's move on. And I wanted just to talk about a couple of the tools before we dive in with Solomon, and we'll finally actually make a start in 1 and 2 Kings itself. The author's purpose tool is the most important tool of all. So I always remember Dale Ralph Davis. Some of you have come across his Old Testament writing, which I think is great. And he's a very sort of dry, understated American. And I think he's hilarious, his sort of sense of humor. But he gives the example of a mother saying to her teenage son, "You've left your dirty rugby kit on the kitchen floor again." And Dale Ralph Davis asked the question, now, why does she say this? It's not what does she say, but what's the author's purpose in saying it? Does she say it just to give information about the whereabouts of different objects in the kitchen? Yeah, the wooden spoon is in the drawer. The toaster's on the side, and your dirty rugby kit's on the kitchen floor again. Oh, thanks, Mum. I now know three bits of information about the whereabouts of things in the kitchen. That is not why she says it. Does she say it just because she enjoys the poetry and cadence of the words? You know, they're two kind of evenly balanced phrases. You've left your dirty rugby kit on the kitchen floor again. It rolls off the tongue nicely. It sort of sounds musical. That is not why she says it. She says, "You've left your dirty rugby kit on the kitchen floor again." And the purpose of it, in this rebuke, this exasperated cry, is to modify her son's behavior vis-a-vis his dirty rugby kit next week. That's, I mean, maybe in vain, but that is what it's for. And Ralph Davies explains all texts, or pretty much all texts in the world, are like this. People don't write texts just to give you information. You know, I'm going to write my book about the red chairs in the Tron and where each one is positioned and where the R's are. I mean, why? That, as soon as I say I'm doing that, you want to ask, why would you do that? I mean, there could conceivably be a purpose for a document about chairs in the Tron, but you'd need to know what the purpose was before I wrote it. And certainly you would need to know what the purpose was before you read it. A book just to contain information is not useful. And 1 and 2 Kings is not there only to give us information. Oh, great, now I know more facts about the period between Solomon and Jehoiakim. It's not for that. Information, and a sermon isn't for that. You know, if you think, oh, great, after booking a day, 1 and 2 Kings, I now know more things about 1 and 2 Kings. That is not the purpose. Well, it's not the purpose that the Lord God has for us in it. Nor is it there just because it sounds beautiful, and the Bible does sound beautiful, but it's not just there to sound good. There is a purpose to change the reader and to persuade us of something, to transform us in some way, to help us to trust God, to help us to hate sin, to cause us to rejoice in Jesus, to increase our hope of the kingdom that we glimpse in the life of Solomon, whatever it is. But there will be an agenda, and the agenda is intrinsic to the text. I don't have to make one up. I don't have to think, now, I've read about Solomon, now what could I teach our congregation about that? Rather, I say, what does the author intend to teach me and my congregation? What was his reason in writing this? So it's intrinsic to the text, and accordingly, try to give each point the weight that the author gives it. So say the things he says and ignore the things he ignores. It's funny, when we read the Old Testament, I think people often want to know things that we don't know. It's, you know, question time. What was going through his mind? I'm going to give you an example. When Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel to sin, made two golden calves, and put one in Dan and one in Bethel, and said, "These are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of Egypt." You're thinking, what is going on in his head? Like, does he know what happens in Exodus? Like, and he kind of seems to know it, because he makes the same animal and he even says the same words as Aaron. So he's got some knowledge of, but not enough knowledge to remember that it was a total disaster that caused God to send a plague to wipe out half the population. So what was going on in his head? And I don't know. And that isn't very important. I'm like, you kind of get a clear politically why he might do it, because he wants to create a separate center of worship in the north so that people won't cross the border to Jerusalem in Judah in the south, because he's worried that then they'll all return to Judah. So I kind of get it politically, but spiritually, what is going on? I don't know. And the author doesn't tell me, and I guess I don't need to know. I mean, it's evil, and the guy is crazy. That's enough. So sometimes we want to know answers that the text doesn't give us. And you know, you have a question time at church, but I don't know. I don't think God's told us that. So say the things he says, ignore the things he ignores. But also, try to say most about the things the author says most about. And that is a challenge to me. For example, when we look at the temple, the author spends a lot of time telling me about how they decorated it. Pomegranates, gold pomegranates, flowers with calyxes. I don't even know what a calyx is, but I think they carve a lot of them, and I think it's part of a flower. There's a lot about that. And all the gold work and exactly how it's done. I think most Christians ignore that. We don't know what to do with that, and we skip over it. But the author thought it was really important. So I'm not saying you have to do a 10-week sermon series on the flowers and the temple, but don't ignore it. Don't skip over it. It's there for a reason. And I guess it's something like, you're supposed to feel the majesty of this place. This is an amazing place. And, of course, they didn't have photos in those days. This is the closest you could get. I mean, they were in exile now. They don't get to see it for themselves, but they get to read this verbal picture of it. Do you know that, I don't know if anyone's been to the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. One of the weirdest rooms in it is the wax, I don't know what it's called, the wax gallery or something. Anyone been there? It's basically the Victorians. They just had this obsession with... sort of wanting to, it's like having a 3D photograph. I think if they'd done it now, they just got a virtual reality headset and you could walk around. But they went to places that not every member of the population could go to, like Rome or, you know, whatever. And then they just thought, brilliant, we will now cast this in wax. And they just cast enormous, you know, frontages of a temple in Ephesus. They enormous column, Hadrian's column from Rome. And there's this actual life-size wax copies of stuff from all around the world. You know, the One Chicken is a bit like that for the temple. So it's not the wax version, it's the verbal version. But you're supposed to be excited about it. And we read it and go, oh, this is a drag because I'm not that interested in gold furnishings. And we kind of need to be. We need to tune in. So don't dodge the things the author talks about. Don't speculate about the things he doesn't talk about. And then let me make it concrete. And here's an example. Okay. 1 Kings chapter 3. Solomon made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. He took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her into the city of David until he'd finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, I've heard sermons on this that have gone, oh dear, oh dear. He made a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt. You're not supposed to do that. You're not supposed to marry foreign women. And then he finished building his own house and the house of the Lord. Well, I don't like the order, his priorities there. He talks about his own house first, and then he talks about the temple second. And it becomes a super negative take on Solomon from one verse. But the chapter is full of praise for Solomon. He's wise, he's altruistic, and the people under him are blessed and happy. And I just don't think the author wants us to make a huge deal about it. It's just background facts. You know, he married Pharaoh's daughter. He built his own house. He built the temple. But the author isn't dwelling on this as an example of how awful Solomon was. It's in a chapter of praise for Solomon. By way of contrast, this is what it looks like when the author wants to tell you that Solomon is being an idiot. So 1 Kings 11. Now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the people of Israel, you shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for surely they will turn your heart after their gods. Solomon clung to these in love. And it goes on to say about some of the abominable gods he worshipped, like Milcom, and so on. Now, that's pretty clear that the author is saying this was a mistake. Whereas in chapter 3, he just doesn't comment on it, right? Now, I'm not saying that the marriage to Pharaoh's daughter was fine or good. I'm just saying it's not the author's point to underline that it was bad. Whereas in chapter 11, it is his point to underline that it's bad. So where do you do your don't intermarry with people who aren't Christians Bible study? Well, you do it from chapter 11. You don't load it into chapter 3. Now, then you've got to say, well, but why is it there in chapter 3 at all? And I think the way it works, and the narrator is really sophisticated, I think. The narrator of 1 and 2 Kings, he deliberately saves all that is wrong until chapter 11. Now, there's wrong things all the way through Solomon's life. In fact, we're told that it was when he was old that his wives lead him astray, but he's marrying them for 40 years. I mean, it takes a long time to marry 700 people. It's one marriage every 3 weeks, I worked out, was on average. You can imagine Solomon with the wedding florist. Hi, it's me. You know, like, I mean, it's mind-blowing. But the marriages have been going on his whole life, but the author doesn't comment on them until the end. Similarly, he's been amassing gold his whole life. But you're not told about the gold and the fact that it comes from Egypt and the fact that he got horses from Egypt as well and all the Deuteronomy alarm bells things until chapter 10. So the author has made a narrator's decision to store up the bad stuff until the end of the narrative. Even though chronologically it's happening all the way through, he's saving it up to the end. Now, why does he do that? I think it's something like this. He wants us to enjoy the beauty of Solomon's kingdom before we know the tragedy of it unraveling. To say this was something really precious that has now been destroyed by sin. And I hate the fact that sin did that. And I want the thing that sin wrecked. That sort of wistfulness. It works the same way as the first 5 minutes at the beginning of an episode of Casualty. You know, how it's always some happy family scene and you can't watch it because you're thinking, oh no. And, you know, look at this lovely new playground suspended underneath this enormous girder, you know, whatever it is. And all you can see is this is going to go wrong. And you can't enjoy it, and yet it's sort of beautiful. It's like that with 1 and 2 Kings. But we get to enjoy it first, and then with hindsight, you go, oh, the clues were there all the way along. Oh, yeah, back in chapter 3, there was that woman he married that was Pharaoh's daughter. You see, so I think the author waits until chapter 11 before he underlines it, and then by all means, notice chapter 3, verse 1. But don't make the big point of it in chapter 3, verse 1, because then you're sort of destroying his craft as a storyteller. You're collapsing the tension of the story. You're giving it all away. There's no cliffhangers. There's no twists. And it wouldn't be very exciting that way. So try to follow the contours of the text. Let the text be the king. Let's start off with Solomon. Just as before we break, we think we've got until, let me just check my timings, 10:45. Is that right for our first session? Yeah, good. So we'll make a start on Solomon. Solomon's wisdom. Solomon's wisdom, Solomon's worship, Solomon's women, or his wives. Solomon's wisdom. Solomon's wisdom comes in 1 Kings 3 and 4, and in 1 Kings 9 and 10. And I think the structure is a kind of sandwich. I've put it there on the sheet for you. Chapter 4 matches chapter 10. Chapter 5 matches chapter 9 quite explicitly. And then in the middle is the story of the temple. We'll think about that later, but Solomon's prosperity and his wisdom is right at the heart of it, is the temple he built. And I guess that's a way of saying the temple required great wisdom to be built, and the temple required a lot of cash. I mean, you know, he was very rich, and he needed to be, because if you read how much gold there was involved in the temple, you realize that the two things go together. But anyway, let's look at his wisdom first. Now, when I did Cornhill years ago with David Jackman, he used to have a few little slogans. I don't know whether you use them in Cornhill, Scotland as well, so I'll test you. Whenever you see the word therefore, ask what it's... Yes, reassuringly, you see these slogans are everywhere. And another one on vocabulary was, Bible words have Bible meanings. I can still remember Jacko saying that. And the point is that words in the Bible, they don't necessarily have the same meaning as the sort of equivalent word in secular usage. And so we've got to let the Bible define it. So I'll give you an example then, the word wisdom. What does the word wisdom mean for our nation? Well, it means having a high IQ, maybe. Like Carol Vorderman, you know, being able to do hard maths or something. It means to be sort of shrewd and to get ahead, something like that. So it's getting a Harvard MBA, or it's getting a top first at Oxford, or it's look at how clever he is. And wisdom in the Bible is really quite different from that. There's some overlap. I mean, Solomon obviously was bright. We're told that he, you know, he wrote 1,000 songs. It's quite a lot of lyrics, and you know, so. He was intelligent, but that isn't the essence of it. And what I want you to do with your neighbour, it's about time for some interaction before we fall asleep. Turn to your neighbour and look at chapter 3 and see if you can define wisdom from the way that the word is used. So give me some adjectives definitions of wisdom in the way it's used in chapter 3. Wisdom is characterised by what? And I'll give you sort of 5 minutes and then we'll feedback. Okay, let's draw back together. So any qualities inherent within this biblical idea of wisdom that you can infer from chapter 3? Wisdom is characterized by what?
Discerning good and evil.
Discerning good and evil, yes. So it's intrinsically moral. In a Bond movie, you can have an evil genius, but in the Bible's thinking, that is a contradiction in terms. You can't be evil and be wise at the same time. So to be wise is to discern between good and evil, verse 9, to discern what is right, verse 11, to do justice, verse 28, so that the wise man prizes what is good. Anything else? Yes, yeah, exactly. It's practical. It's less about sort of knowing obscure facts about maths. I mean, there's a certain esoteric pleasure in knowing that 1,729 is the smallest number expressible as the sum of two cubes in two different ways. I love this story. There's a mathematician called Ramanujan who... went to see his friend G.H. Hardy, who's also a mathematician. And he said, oh, I'm sorry, I rode here in cab number 1,729. I'm sorry it wasn't a more interesting number. And immediately he said, no, on the contrary, it's the smallest number expressible as the sum of two cubes in two different ways. I mean, how would you even know that? Anyway, that's kind of interesting. And that's very, very clever to know that. But that isn't, it's not wise. I mean, it's not practical. It doesn't do any good. Whereas Solomon's wisdom immediately is demonstrated in this court case of the two prostitutes with the baby and the dead baby and the live baby. And it's kind of clever, but it's also practically beneficial to the country that it was clever. Yeah. Anything else to say about that demonstration of wisdom? I mean, it's an ingenious solution, cut it in half. And it's so famous that even people who don't know anything about the Bible know this story. So, you know, it's... But what else does it tell us about him apart from that he's clever? It's interesting that it's prostitutes, isn't it? So this is equitable. I mean, everyone benefits from this. This is not just for the elite in the university or the highest court of the civil service. I mean, people in the gutter, because this king is just, they get justice. So that the lowest rung of society benefits from it. It's beautifully equitable. Knowing what to do, yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so it's a sort of shrewd on the basis of what he does know. I put a couple more. It's humble. And this is often the absolute opposite, isn't it, of wisdom in this world. So unlike so many clever people in our world, Solomon does not think of himself as a self-made man. He doesn't pat himself on the back. He says, I am a little child, God, and I'm daunted by the job that you've given me of leading this great people. I don't know how to go in and come out. Help me, Lord. You know, that there's a demeanor of, he doesn't go, hey, well, you know, given that my IQ is so high, check me out. It's like, Lord, help me. I'm empty-handed. So and I love that verse in Humble. I love that verse in James that talks about the humility that comes from wisdom, James chapter 4. And that just tells me that wisdom in the Bible is not the same as cleverness in the world, because humility does not come from cleverness. You know, did I mention my degree was the first? I just left my certificate out so you could notice it. You know, that we cleverness does not show itself in humility, but wisdom does. And it's altruistic. I mean, it's not really for himself. I mean, it ends up benefiting altruistic. There we are. It does benefit him, but it's not what it's for. And God's really pleased about that. He says, yeah, I'm pleased that you didn't ask something for yourself, riches or long life, but you ask something for others. And so I'm going to give you riches and long life as well, as a bonus. But God is delighted that he asked for wisdom rather than riches, but in response, God gives it together with riches. And later, Solomon reflects on this himself, Proverbs chapter 3. Blessed is the one who finds wisdom, the one who gets understanding. The gain from her is better than gain from silver. Her profit is better than gold. She is more precious than jewels. Nothing you desire can compare with her. Long life is in her hand. In her left hand are riches and honor. So Solomon is really wise. And just very close, I want to turn to 1 Kings 10. This is one of my favorite paragraphs in the Bible, and I particularly like it because I think that this paragraph is the origin of three well-known British idioms, English idioms, and I think they all come from here. Now, someone who's a scholar of Elizabethan English or something, please tell me if that's not true. I'd love to know for sure, but I can't find any occurrence of these phrases before they crop up in the King James Bible in 1 Kings 10. So see if you can spot the phrases. When the king, Queen of Sheba heard that the fame of Solomon concerning the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions. I love that. Apparently you're quite wise. I'm not so sure. Sit my exam. I love that. She's not easily persuaded. She came to Jerusalem with a very great retinue, with camels bearing spices, very much gold and precious stones. When she came to Solomon, she told him all that was on her mind, and Solomon answered all her questions. There was nothing hidden from the king that he could not explain to her. And when the queen of Sheba had seen all the wisdom of Solomon, the house he built, the food of his table, the seating of his officials, the attendance of his servants, their clothing, his cupbearers, his burnt offerings that he offered at the house of the Lord, it took her breath away. Is that the first time that's used? I think so. There was no breath left in her. And she said to the king, the report was true, I heard in my own land, of your words and your wisdom. But I didn't believe the reports until I came and saw it with my own eyes. Is that the first time that's used? Maybe. And then, behold, I wasn't told the half of it. Third one. It's good, isn't it? Just in one paragraph, three of them. Anyway, that's just a bit of fun. But she realizes that people are with that he's very wise. And here's the question: how do I apply this to me? Who am I in the story? Am I Solomon? So do I go, Lord, you made him wise and rich, please make me wise and rich? I mean, the wise bit, probably yes. You know, James says you do not have wisdom because you don't ask God, so ask for it. But am I supposed to just want what he got? And that gets us into problems, doesn't it? Because Solomon was enormously wealthy and prosperous, and is that the expectation for the Christian? This gets us into kind of prosperity gospel territory. So how do I not go there? I think the answer is that Solomon, first and foremost, does not correspond to me because he's the king. I'm not the king. Who do I fit into the story? Well, maybe I'm a subject of Solomon. I'm one of the people who lives in Solomon's Israel. And I think this verse I'm about to read really helps with this, because it turns out that when the king is really wise, it blesses everyone. It blesses the prostitutes who are about to lose her child to another woman who's lying. It blesses people who enjoy prosperity because their king leads them in good ways and prosperous ways. And so I don't have to be him to benefit from him. And I love this verse. Verse 8 and 9. Happy are your men, happy are your servants who continually stand before you and hear your wisdom. And here's the key verse. Blessed be the Lord your God, who's delighted in you and set you on the throne of Israel. Because the Lord loved Israel forever, he's made you king, that you may execute justice and righteousness. Do you see that? Because the Lord loved Israel, he made you king. Sometimes we say we get the leaders we deserve. And you know, Boris Johnson is not having a very happy time, is he? But we probably deserve that in our country. The more we turn our backs on God. But a people that loved God, a people that God loved, what kind of king would he give them? A really great king. So I think you could say this verse to Jesus. Jesus, God must have really loved your people to make you their king. That's the essence of it, isn't it? Wow, this people gets a king as wise as you, as humble as you, as altruistic as you, as equitable, as fair to everybody, the poor and the rich and the downtrodden and the prostitute. And that, wow, God must love them to make them a king who is just and righteous and wise. Now, what we're doing here is we're doing the typology thing. Yeah, Solomon's going to go wrong. It's all going to go badly. It's going to go down the tube. That's true. But at this point, I'm getting a glimpse, a type, an image of a kingdom blessed by God under a king. And at the end of it, when Solomon goes wrong, what I'm going to say then is, I want a king that's like Solomon, but that doesn't go wrong. Like, I want the wise bit of Solomon, I just don't want the foolish bit of Solomon. If only I could have a king that was like Solomon in these ways, but not like him in the other ways. And that's the king that we've got. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for King Jesus, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge. Thank you for the glimpse we get 3,000 years ago of a kingdom where everyone is happy, where justice rules, where people are prosperous, where they love and praise their king who is so good to them. And Lord, that gives us a concrete picture of the society and the kingdom that we look forward to. Lord, it must be that you love us very much, that you would give us a king like our Lord Jesus Christ. And we praise you in his name. Amen.